When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to CAMH.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hip-hop and journalism have never gotten along too well. Perhaps it's because the news media began by dismissing hip-hop as a fad, and then evolved into demonizing it as a menace. Or perhaps it's because the magazines and radio stations and other media machinery that sprung up to specifically cover hip-hop quickly became a rabid hype machine that capitalized on and exaggerated things like coastal rivalries and interpersonal conflict between rappers, sometimes with tragic results. Or maybe it's just because hip-hop is all about seizing the right to tell one's own story. Baked into the culture is a recognition of the power that comes from representing yourself in the first person, in your own words. Whatever you chalk it up to, the relationship between hip-hop and journalists through the years has been not good.
To millions of teenagers, most of them white, he's the poet laureate of gangster rap, the rap style of a ghetto world where everybody's got a gun, women are bitches, and shooting cops is fair game.
The chorus, it goes on and on. Is that related to the lowest unemployment ever, basically, okay, for African Americans?
You know, the white media's been very upset about some of the things you say and your son. The way I get them caused me a little very upset by the things you're saying.
This is why I say that hip-hop has done more damage to young African Americans than racism in recent years.
Add it all up, and you have a long-standing state of suspicion on the part of rappers towards journalists, which is why hip-hop evolution is so great. Every rapper interviewed on this Netflix series, now in its third season, seems to embrace the show's host with wide open arms and a big friendly smile. For once, they're given a chance to celebrate hip-hop, not defend it, apologize for it, or explain it. And they all seem to really appreciate that. And they open up. Ice Cube is a nice guy with no attitude. Snoop Dogg gets kind of sad. Ghostface Killah, big sweetie. All of these rappers greet the journalist interviewing them like a friend, and they reveal things to him that you are not expecting. And that journalist is Shad. Remember Shad? When last I spoke with him, Shad had just been given the best worst job in Canadian media. He was Gian Gomeshi's replacement on CBC's Q. It did not go well. And his rough time on that show and his eventual loss of that job was covered in excruciating detail by the Globe and Mail and by others. The consensus seemed to be that, you know, Shad might be a great MC and a really nice guy, but not a great interviewer, and certainly not a journalist. Well, here's what the Globe and Mail did not cover. Shad and his hip-hop evolution team won a Peabody, which is like the Pulitzer Prize for broadcast journalism. They also won an Emmy. And their show, Hip Hop Evolution, this joyful, respectful, loving oral history of an art form that rose up from the rubble to take over the world, it is a remarkable piece of journalism. The most exhaustive documentary about hip hop so far. And Shad, along with series director Darby Wheeler and writer Rodrigo Baskunin, join me in our Toronto studio to talk about it all in a minute. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Colin Bird, Cody L. Baudreau, Malcolm Fraser, Brittany Ayotte, Aaron Besdeo, Bob Chandler, Alex Eddington, and Aaron Goose.
I'm Aaron Goose from Kimberley, BC, and I support Canada Land because I've been following Jesse Brown since his days at Search Engine, and it's good to hear him finally hosting a show with a good theme song.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer. And it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Hip-hop and journalism have never gotten along too well. Perhaps it's because the news media began by dismissing hip-hop as a fad, and then evolved into demonizing it as a menace. Or perhaps it's because the magazines and radio stations and other media machinery that sprung up to specifically cover hip-hop quickly became a rabid hype machine that capitalized on and exaggerated things like coastal rivalries and interpersonal conflict between rappers, sometimes with tragic results. Or maybe it's just because hip-hop is all about seizing the right to tell one's own story. Baked into the culture is a recognition of the power that comes from representing yourself. in the first person, in your own words. Whatever you chalk it up to, the relationship between hip-hop and journalists through the years has been not good.
To millions of teenagers, most of them white, he's the poet laureate of gangsta rap, the rap style of a ghetto world where everybody's got a gun, women are bitches, and shooting cops is fair game.
Yeah, Donald Trump. Yeah, Donald Trump. The chorus, it goes on and on. Is that related to the lowest unemployment ever, basically, okay, for African Americans?
You know, the white media's been very upset about some of the things you say and your son. The way I get them caused me a little very upset by the things you're saying.
This is why I say that hip-hop has done more damage to young African Americans than racism in recent years.
Add it all up, and you have a long-standing state of suspicion on the part of rappers towards journalists, which is why hip-hop evolution is so great. Every rapper interviewed on this Netflix series, now in its third season, seems to embrace the show's host with wide open arms and a big friendly smile. For once, they're given a chance to celebrate hip-hop, not defend it, apologize for it, or explain it. And they all seem to really appreciate that. And they open up. Ice Cube is a nice guy with no attitude. Snoop Dogg gets kind of sad. Ghostface Killa, big sweetie. All of these rappers greet the journalist interviewing them like a friend, and they reveal things to him that you are not expecting. And that journalist is Shad. Remember Shad? When last I spoke with him, Shad had just been given the best, worst job in Canadian media. He was Gian Gomeshi's replacement on CBC's Q. It did not go well. And his rough time on that show and his eventual loss of that job was covered in excruciating detail by the Globe and Mail and by others. The consensus seemed to be that, you know, Shad might be a great MC and a really nice guy, but not a great interviewer and certainly not a journalist. Well, here's what the Globe and Mail did not cover. Shad and his hip-hop evolution team won a Peabody, which is like the Pulitzer Prize for broadcast journalism. They also won an Emmy. And their show, Hip-Hop Evolution, this joyful, respectful, loving oral history of an art form that rose up from the rubble to take over the world, it is a remarkable piece of journalism. The most exhaustive documentary about hip-hop so far. And Shad, along with series director Darby Wheeler and writer Rodrigo Baskunin, join me in our Toronto studio to talk about it all in a minute. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Colin Bird, Cody L. Baudreau, Malcolm Fraser, Brittany Ayotte, Aaron Besdeo, Bob Chandler, Alex Eddington, and Aaron Goose.
I'm Aaron Goose from Kimberley, BC, and I support Canada Land because I've been following Jesse Brown since his days at Search Engine, and it's good to hear him finally hosting a show with a good theme song.
My name is Darby Wheeler, and I am a film and TV director, directed Hip Hop Evolution, which I believe we're speaking about today.
We have very similar resumes. My name is Rodrigo Baskunin. With Darby, I wrote, produced, and directed some episodes of Hip Hop Evolution.
And my name is Shad, Shadrach Kabango. I'm an artist and also the host of Hip Hop Evolution.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
I guess the first thing I would have to recognize is just like the sheer number of people you talk to, Shad. Like, what strikes you first is like you really booked some big stars. Like, it's not just like, yeah, you got Snoop and Ice Cube and Ice-T and Sean Combs and LL and Lil' Kim. But there's also like Afrika Bambaataa, Grand Wizard Theodore, Kool Herc, Fab Five Freddy, Roxanne Shanté, like literally the people who invented, some of the people who invented this thing that took over the world. Mm-hmm. And then Prince Paul was in there and Primo and Pete Rock and like Rod Digga, whatever happened to Rod Digga, she's in the show. There are over 130 interviews.
Oh, wow.
And you have 4 episodes in your season. So how the hell did you book this show?
At the beginning, first season, it was mostly Darby and I, and we would split it up sometimes just like based on our sort of psychological profile of what how, what we thought this person was like. So I got the nerds, Or Darby got the divas. That was kind of like the division. Uh-huh. Darby would be like, this guy seems like super nerdy. Yeah. He's like, you should talk to him.
But then, 2 hours later, you're like, thanks for that. Yeah.
But we did a lot of the chasing first season. And then second to fourth, we had a dedicated talent producer and then an American producer, a talent producer. And then we'd also have local fixers that, you know, were friends or people we found. So it was a real combination of all things. And then also at the same time, we're still doing
it. Yeah, I would say we drove it, though. Yeah. I mean, I used to work at Much Music with George Stromblopoulos in the hour at CBC. So I know how to chase people pretty good, as Rodrigo does too. Just finding, but with hip hop, it was different. You had to sometimes find like Run DMC's brother, you know, like, or weird angles to get numbers to old school guys, right?
It's like a game.
So-and-so knows so-and-so. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, hip hop's an industry, but it's also a community. I have to imagine as you get to season three that like word gets around like, well, I mean, it's what we do. We say, well, here are the people who've been on the show so far, and then people can speak of the experience, whether it was a good one or not. So
there's like a domino effect to it, but it is really impressive. Like, I had a call with a guy I know who's like a VP at, was it Universal or Sony in LA? And he's trying to make documentary films about music. He's like, how do you guys get all these people? Because I'm trying to get these people, and they record for us. They're on our label. And I can't get them to sit down for our productions. I'm like, yeah, these guys kind of know how to play this game of like, sometimes it is talking to their brother or the person no one knows who influenced them. Sometimes we'd sit down and have an interview with them, and then we can approach that person we really want to sit down with and say, yeah, we spoke with this person. They're like, oh, you know your stuff then.
We were strategic about it at the beginning, especially. We knew that you could build it bottom up. So you get Kool Herc, and that, you know, that'll make Flash do it, which will make Bam do it. And if you got those three guys, okay, now Melly Mel will do it. Oh, now you got all those guys, so Run DMC will do it. Second, third, and fourth season, it was a little bit different because by that point, the first season it aired, you could say, oh, it's won some awards. You know, it airs on Netflix. All of that helped. It was like a package now.
Part of the pleasure of watching it is there are moments where like, oh, they got this big star, but then just like, oh, like Shad is just walking into somebody's apartment. And on the other side of that door is Grand Wizard Theater. Like, I'm just like picturing in my head, like, I guess you just go to the airport and get on a plane and go to New York and get in a cab and then knock on a door. And when that door opens, who's standing there.
Well, the funny thing, and I, from my artist life, I know this too. Like, if I have to sit down for an interview, oftentimes the place I'll suggest is my house. This is easier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's easier for me. I can just wake up, come downstairs, and we can just, and I'm comfortable. So it kind of works out well because it looks great, but it is also just easier for the artists.
Well, and it's interesting as you get into the history of hip hop, the further you get, the nicer the rooms, you know?
Most definitely,
some of the people who are most fundamental to this thing, everybody seems to be doing fine, but like some people are just like, yeah, this is my apartment. And
Kool Herc drove up in a really crappy Honda Civic, like a 1988 Honda Civic, you know?
In general, the pioneers, like the real pioneers, like the 70s Bronx Harlem guys,
they missed out on the payday.
They didn't get it. Yeah. And even when you move forward, like even through the 80s, like people who are big, like a Rakim or a Kane, like, you never really know because the deals were so bad back then.
Yeah.
What they really got. You know, like you have big groups that really never
I don't think they got any. They tour.
Some of them are still hustling, I guess, to whatever that name can translate into.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard to guess. You like so and so is doing fine, but an equivalent artist who you think would might be okay has nothing, you know?
So it's crazy.
Yeah. You kind of can feel that after a while, like who's doing well, who isn't.
Okay, so Canada Land deals with journalism, and I want to discuss what you did as a work of journalism, and I know you resist the term definitive, but I think it's the most exhaustive.
I would agree with that. Yeah, definitive is tough because there's a lot missing.
Yeah, I mean, how can you? Three seasons so far, four episodes a season. I mean, but this seems like, as an oral history, as an attempt to document it, this seems like the biggest swing at it so far. And it got me thinking about the relationship between hip-hop and journalism writ large, which has been kind of a strained relationship from the start. I think maybe because hip-hop itself is a form of journalism, you know, the famous Chuck D quote, this like Black America's CNN, and, you know, the emphasis on telling your own story. And I think a real awareness of the power that exists in who gets to tell your story and seizing that power and saying, well, I'm going to tell my own story. And then when other people come in to tell it, I mean, some of the archival footage you dig up of the early news media reactions to hip-hop.
There is mounting concern that the music teenagers are listening to, rap, is getting too explicit.
Susan Pierce is a parent who is not impressed by 2 Live Crew.
That's your job as a parent, is to set some standards for your kids.
I think this is nothing but verbal pollutants.
Federal judge in South Florida declared 2 Live Crew's album, Nasty As They Wanna Be, obscene by local community standards.
That stuff has not aged well.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, just the disgust and the demonization.
2 Live Crew is a good example. In season 2, there's like a whole news crew of people that's just so great. Really,
yeah, the moral panic. Yes. I mean, and then the Senate committees and Tipper Gore and all that stuff, I remember, of just people were terrified. And they were just very dismissive of it as a form.
Yeah, the general sense was it was going to be a trend. Like, it was going to disappear, right? It was a novelty.
Are you all Canadians in this room?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How the hell are you the ones telling the most exhaustive history of hip-hop from the beginning? Like, how is this your work of journalism?
It's funny because, you know, here we are in 2019, and I think there's an understood value of the history of hip-hop now. Yeah. But when this series was first being pitched in 2012, 2013... which is not that long ago, really, it wasn't the same. So when Banger, the production company, was pitching the series, it wasn't like everyone's like, amazing idea. Like, here's your money. Run with it. People were like, not sure if that's going to work. Who cares
about
this?
They were scared, too.
There was a lot of skepticism about the value of this, of telling this history. So what that did is it presented an opportunity. Because imagine if that's the same conversation that's happening with possibly other production companies or journalists in the United States, and they're getting that same pushback where people are not really interested. So there was an opportunity there for people to come in. And, you know, we just happened to be the ones that got that chance. But I do think there was also an advantage to being Canadian to it. And we heard this from Americans, not just me speculating, in that we're a blank slate. We don't come with any baggage.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a particular bias towards any artists or regions, you know, whereas I think a lot of the more well-known journalists, if they had tried the project, might already be tainted in some way by their history. You know, things that we don't even know about, right? Whatever relationships they had, where they're from, et cetera, et cetera. So being Canadian really kind of like, people saw us without judgment. You know, they're just like, okay, they're an inoffensive Canadian crew and it's going to be really like nice and innocent, right? Not that there was anything unsavory about it, but they were just open to it. So it helped us from that perspective.
That's one aspect of it. And the other one, I wonder, like, Canadians kind of famously seem to be able to take an overview approach. Like, we just grow up consuming so much American media.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have the same kind of like regional associate. I mean, maybe there is a Toronto to New York kind of thing, that, you know, but there's also just seems to be like, if you're Canadian and into comedy, you become a student of comedy. If you're Canadian into rock, you become a student of rock.
Right.
Is there like a Poindexter hip hop nerd aspect of this where the Canadianness helps you?
I think so too. I mean, it's just like Darby was saying, right? Like, he grew up near Windsor or near Chatham, Windsor area, right? So like certain artists, like let's take, for example, E-40.
The moon is full, look at the dark cloud. Sitting in my scraper watching Oakland going wild, ta-da. I don't bump mainstream, I knock underground. All that other sugar-coated and watered down. I'm from the Bay where we have...
No one in Toronto likes E4, like, to a great extent, right? Like, it's just... But in Detroit, they love E4.
Yeah, and Too Short, I used to buy those records there. So, yeah, I definitely
Houston,
have a different...
In Houston, they love E40. It's like, I do feel like... That's absolutely
a good example. E-40.
Yeah, E-40 is great. Because if you go to Texas, E-40 is the biggest rapper like ever outside of like Ghetto Boys.
What about you as an MC from here?
Same thing.
Do you feel like being Canadian frees you from having to kind of be too affiliated with something? Like you can kind of just love everything permission to love everything?
I think so. And like Drake's kind of a prime example, right? Like he kind of popped up doing a style that everybody loved in Houston because it kind of touched on what they were doing, and obviously New York, but Fonte from North Carolina is one of his favorite rappers. Like he is this hybrid of so many styles of rap. He was maybe the first guy to be like, I don't have a cadence. I don't have a style. Like I love music. I love rap music and I kind of do it all. So yeah, I think so for sure.
There's a freedom to that.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. We never really got pushback from people.
I don't think people saw us as outsiders because Rodrigo had ran a hip hop magazine for a decade, and I worked at Much, and and Shad was already an MC. People were very aware, like all the De La Soul guys love Shad. I just remember that, right? Like, so it wasn't that we were outsiders.
That must feel good.
But I, but I definitely, you know, Nelson George, the journalist, he was worked with us on the first season, and me and Rodrigo did some early research sessions with him in Toronto, and that was, he literally, first thing he said was, he goes, "You guys are so lucky to be Canadian. You don't even know." And so we really didn't know, right? But it was that sort of, like you said, like Rodrigo mentioned, no baggage. There's, and I actually think there's, I always said an example to Rodrigo, you know, BBC and English journalism and music journalism did reggae so good. They just covered it. And that sort of was our goal with hip hop, to be, make Canadians be the ones who, like you said, have that lens that could look, you know, and not be so inside, you know, and have things that would curve your perspective in a way.
And then when the door knocks and they open their home to, and it's you, Shad, they really seem very, very comfortable.
Yeah, I mean,
you're a stranger to almost all these people, right?
Yeah, I think the hard thing is getting people to sit down, right? Like the chasing that we were talking about at the beginning. But once they're sitting down, they're talking about hip-hop. They love it. Like, I think the best example is probably Lil' Kim. Do you remember that first rhyme you kicked for Biggie?
It was on Fulton Street, right? I was a baby, you know, 16, 17, basically. I'm so embarrassed. But I used to really like Buckshot. I used to rhyme like him. I would listen to Black Moon over and over again. I don't remember it all, but I remember I said something to the sense of, I'm so hot, I'm hotter than the sun, now where the man or who that to come or whatever.
You hit him with the Buckshot flow.
Hit him with the Buckshot. Hit him with the Buckshot flow. And he was like, wait a minute, what? Like that big ass voice coming out of this little ass girl. He was like,
she is in another world now. You know, you can see like she's in a sort of a different world. She's still in hip hop, but she's
also. Well, we have to unpack that a bit.
Sure. But yeah.
What's this different world of Lil' Kim's? It's Lil' Kim world.
You know, she's in the world, a world I'm unfamiliar with of like, you know, dressing up and Instagram and all.
She's like an icon.
She's in a very, very moneyed environment. And I'm like, okay, here's Lil' Kim. And then she's like, she really opens up to you.
A lot of people ask me about that interview in particular because they see the photos and see how much she's changed and they wonder, what's she like anyways? And I was like, honestly, once we started talking about hip hop, she was like maybe the coolest person we talked to.
She
so
is cool.
Yeah, like,
I agree.
Funny, like street.
Yeah.
And
still
and
Kim, everybody says that about her. Like she looks different.
Kim.
Like people in her world are like, that's still Kim.
Yeah.
You know, people always say that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm getting at is like, getting people to sit down for an interview, it's not promoting their project or whatever, is probably the hard part of the game. Once they're sitting down and they're talking about the music they love, the era where all these special things happened in their life, like, they're just happy to do it.
I think that you do connect with them on the level of, like, a mutual love.
Yeah,
and I think
so.
There's something about you, to give you some respect as an interviewer, that again and again rests these very human, unexpected moments out of people who we know as like almost like superheroes or cartoon characters or like whether they're icons or however you think of them. You don't think of them as just like a person telling a story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I enjoyed that aspect of it, kind of trying to prepare myself to like receive someone's story, you know. But I do think there's a thing about connecting around music, and it certainly again helped once the first season was out. So like Snoop, for example, saw the first season, loved it. And when he sat down to talk, I think he got what the show is and what we're looking for, right?
Yeah.
So when people had that experience, it was always a lot easier too. Like he, I mean, he's a pro, but he also, because he saw the show, I think he understood.
Yeah,
okay.
He was different though, right? You're right about that. Because I actually sort of, I did tell him what we were going to do, and it was about Tupac a lot, right? So he didn't go into Snoop, you know, funny, he had a different vibe about him.
I've never seen him like that in an interview and this moment. And I don't know, like not everybody listening will know the context of like talking about Biggie versus Tupac, like again, like, like the subject of like endless dorm room conspiracy theories, Illuminati, there's been documentaries made about this and who assassinated, and then you've just got Snoop like realizing that his own son is the same age as Tupac when Tupac was killed.
I was riding on the freeway and I heard it on the radio station. Like 25, my oldest son is 25 years old. I'm thinking like, damn, that's only how old he was. He did a lot, but he didn't get a chance to do what he needed to do. He had more to do.
And it kind of builds. You've got, you know, Sean Combs just remembering his friend.
I was ready to quit. I wasn't going to put out any more records. Then I was watching TV one day. You know, one of those times of despair that nobody is around. And you're like crying on the floor, and this, the self-pity is at an all-time high, and you're like asking God why. And then I just heard Every Breath You Take by the Police. I just took it as a sign. And wow. Sometimes you just need that little bit of light to be able to express yourself. And I thought that the best thing I could do was not give up. I was down and I was out, but I wasn't finished. But all I could do was get up and start to fight. And that's the way, you know, Big would have wanted it.
And you bring him to tears thinking about that. And then the way that oral histories work of like everybody kind of comparing notes. And what you kind of get is a different telling of that, of a story that I thought I'd never want to hear.
Same here.
Mm-hmm. And the telling is, this was idiotic. This was a tragic series of mistakes and circumstances and accidents that never had to happen. And now these two incredibly talented people aren't with us because of it. It's very sad. It was the episode I was least interested in watching and the one that I think I might have learned the most from.
We were definitely concerned about making it because of exactly what you said. You know, it's been covered so much. And we knew, okay, originally we were only going to do one episode about it. And even at points, we're like, should we just run over this whole thing?
Yeah, have them gone.
Give it a quick gloss.
Get out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the prism of the show is what's happening to the music and the culture. That's the guiding principle, which will explain, like, why people aren't there or why people are there. You know, that is our guiding principle. So when we sat back, it was like, we're telling the story of the East and West with respect to how it will ultimately affect the culture, which is what you get at the end of the second episode, which is the emergence of Puff and this jiggy sound of hip-hop collectively wanting to breathe a sigh of relief and, like, look to a brighter sound to forget what they've just been through.
Yeah, know? And the hyper-commercialization that followed and it taking a turn towards party music. You know, that's, you can't skip that chapter.
Exactly. So, but they're connected. They're connected ideas, they're connected moments, that the fact that these tragedies happen and they're sort of this realization of hip-hop's collective power and responsibility is a part of the same story as the emergence of the Jiggy era. Mm-hmm. Those are the same thing. They're just, you know, cause and effect in a way. So that was why we ended up telling it the way we did.
Yeah, you're not going to satisfy everybody too. Like you said, there's a million things about Biggie and Tupac's murders, and there's those kind of viewers who are like, why didn't they go tell this part of the story? Yeah. There's a lot of interesting, inside stuff. And
as far as research and writing episodes, that was the one that drove us the most crazy. And editing. Never mind. Yeah. That was the one that drove, because it was just, there's so many pathways you can go down. And you just have to, again, you'd have to remember what your principles are about. It's like, it's about music and culture, which is why our entry point to that is to explain, this is where hip hop is right now. The West has risen. The East has come back. And now there's sort of this standoff, stalemate. But there's also a history here of kind of like a subliminal animosity that's always existed. So that's why we start there with those stories of, like, what was the foundation that could even allow something so silly as a bi-coastal war, which, you know, now sounds just really crazy and ridiculous. Yeah. But at the time, there were, like, precedents for it. So that's why we go there. So you can understand, like, how this all unfolds, right? And it was really, that was the guiding principle of that whole episode. How does it happen in hip-hop, right? And what is hip-hop's story about it?
The guiding principle of the whole thing, I think, is joy. And the way that I think you're able to get the moments you get is through just whatever else is happening. I mean, you're in some strange situations. He's got this dog and, like, you know, or you're just in somebody's apartment. Like, you know, but whatever happens is, like, that's the point that everybody can agree on. And some of those moments, aside from these dramas, like Q-Tip shaking his head thinking about Illmatic. And just like, it's a masterpiece.
That was what I was really happy that these guys did in the editing, is they made the show entertaining and fun to watch. Because I knew how thoroughly researched it was. But I was like, I hate when music docs, like, there's been music docs that I've watched, I'm not going to name them my name, but they're like about a music or era or a group that I love, And I'm like, why am I going to wash the dishes right now? Like, I'm actually bored watching this.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't contain any of the joy that is actually in the music.
In which case, what's the point?
Yeah. Right? So I do, that's probably my favorite thing about Hip Hop Evolution is that it is entertaining. It's fun to watch, just like the music is fun to listen to.
It's beyond that. Like, the look on your face when, like, Supernatural is rhyming and works in Hip Hop Evolution into it.
When it comes to spitting, yo, I'm never disrespected. There is no confusion. Write the Constitution. Sitting here, this is Hip Hop Evolution. Woo! And yo, I'm still here. And that's the way we take it. It's nice. I'ma stop right there because we wrecking it, right?
There's just a sense from you the whole time. They're like, I get to be here.
Absolutely. And I never wanted to hide that. And I wanted to even highlight, like, yo, freestyling is amazing. We don't really do it anymore. Yeah. Like, whatever. Like, it's not exactly part of the culture anymore. But it's amazing. And this is part of why the culture spread. It was because of amazing things like breakdancing and freestyling and, like,
pure skills.
And these moments. Like, I do love the Nas section, because it highlights, yo, when this guy came out, there's a lot of people we talked to, they're like, we were working on albums and we stopped.
Yeah.
Like, really good artists, they're like, we stopped.
Illmatic is right there with What's Going On, Marvin Gaye. Like, it's that good. Like, it really is. It's a masterpiece. And I don't really throw that word around and shit, but it's a masterpiece. Yeah.
Illmatic changed everything. Like, you had to be better, period. And, like, to capture what that means to, like, an entire genre and culture is, like, it should feel exciting. It shouldn't feel anything less than exciting.
And I think it's, like, a history that recognizes it's not just simply, like, the style evolved and this sound came out of this. Like, no, like, individuals, geniuses.
17-year-old, 18-year-old geniuses. Like, how young they were, too, is just, like, amazing. Grandmaster Flash at 13, discovering new ways to use a turntable.
Yeah.
You know, as a junior high kid.
Yeah. Kids.
Yeah. You know, like, revolutionizing music and what that must have felt like when people at a party are hearing a section of a record looped for the first time.
Yeah.
They'd never heard that. They had no imagination for how that could even be possible.
Well, and that's the kind of original joy is taking... Like, it's not supposed to be an instrument. It's something you're just supposed to buy shit with this. You're just a consumer.
And you put it on.
And you turn it into an instrument.
Yes.
And that's a foundational act of joy that everything is built on.
Yeah.
Was there a favorite for you? Was there like an interview that...
I guess I have two categories of favorites. Like, there's some that are my favorite because I really learned something. Like, there was one interview I remember we had with Angie Martinez. And that was just interesting learning about, you know, hip hop journalism and stuff. But also, there's just a moment in that interview where it clicked for me that, like, oh, hip hop is New York culture. Because we've been talking about it even here, like, it's an American thing. But it's actually New York culture. I was just talking with her and she was talking. I was like, she has no other culture but this. Like, this is her life and how she lives and breathes and whatever. So there are moments like that, interviews that I really like. And then there's just artists that I'm a huge fan of. Like Q-Tip was a big one for all
of us.
Chad
was tripping on when he was Q-Tip. That was the only interview that I noticed that he was a little nervous about. There's two.
Were you nervous?
Yeah.
I didn't even notice that I was nervous. But like I didn't think I would be nervous.
Yeah.
And then just sitting there in front of Q-Tip, it was like, you just get this like shock of like Q-Tip, everything my career is because you live.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he is.
I don't know. It's like a weird feeling of like, pretty much most of what I understand of hip hop is like you.
And the people you inspire.
And the people you inspire.
Yeah.
And then, you know, KRS-One would be another highlight of an interview just because.
Yeah, that was a great one.
I always put it this way. Like, if you had my job of interviewing all these rappers, but you never heard rap music, you'd interview KRS-One and you'd be like, he's the best rapper.
Right, based on the interview?
Based on the interview.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's so charismatic, it's insane. Today's topic, self-destruction, humiliate the rap audience's
bugging. It's one of two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another. Let's come to the show to unity. We know exactly who we are. This is what it means to be conscious, to be awake, to be aware.
I feel like it needs to be underlined that you are a hell of an interviewer in this.
Oh, thank you.
And you know, we're in the context in Canada land of the Canadian media. How do I get at this? Let me just read you some Globe and Mail headlines about you.
Sure.
Q, Why is Shad so bad?
I remember that one. Yeah. That was
rapper broadcaster Shad being replaced as host of CBC's Q. CBC starting with clean slate as Q relaunches under Tom Power. Here's a Globe and Mail headline I can't seem to find. Shad just won a Peabody and an Emmy for his journalism. Why is that not a story?
I don't know. I can't answer that question.
It's probably hard for you to have a perspective on it, I'm guessing.
Yeah, no, yeah. I don't know. You know, I don't know. Like, do you think the Canadian media has missed hip-hop evolution? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's been completely ignored. Hmm. It's a Netflix show that is being watched. As far as I can tell, Netflix doesn't give you their numbers, right?
So doing really well.
Yeah. It seems like it's doing really well. Yeah. Canadians give each other awards for journalism. Like, there are more awards than there are journalists at this point. I don't really give a shit about awards. I want a Peabody. The Peabody is...
Yeah, we're pretty happy about the Peabody.
The Peabody is the Broadcaster's Pulitzer. Yeah. That's one of the biggest journalism awards that exists. That's a big deal that you want a Peabody.
We didn't even submit to it. They found us, too, so it's interesting. Yeah.
I think it's weird. I think that... I mean, look, you've been on the show before, and then I've talked about you on the show before, and I thought that you got a raw deal. I think that the way that you were set up, I think that show is a fucking hard show.
100%.
A daily show.
Yes. Yeah.
To put somebody in who hasn't done that kind of work before with the entire eyes of the nation on them following the Gian Gomeshi scandal, that was my feeling when I spoke to you about that. It was like, be careful out there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah, I mean, look, I knew that would be... I mean, challenging is an understatement. Like, I knew it would be basically impossible.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I was up for that. And I don't know why, but I've just never cared that much about the opinions of strangers.
You enjoyed it too, right? I mean, you told me this.
Yeah, I did. Oh, the job?
Yeah.
I loved it. Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I really did.
There is a difference, and maybe it's by virtue of the experience of Q, but I also feel like it's like... I don't know. That's a machinery, and people put you in situations, and you've got to kind of find common ground with people doing theater and people doing this. Like, things, you know, there's no one who's an expert on all of those different things. But the connection you have to this material, I don't know. I just think that because you took so much heat as an interviewer, I feel like as much attention should be paid to the fact that you're very good at it.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was a good training ground. I want to be honest. I was very grateful for Q for Shad because he had this memory thing that was worked more in that. Like, you were pretty good memorizing stuff anyways.
Yeah.
But you were on another level. And then also, like, doing voiceovers, he just had a different... Yeah. I saw it, like, immediately. I was just like, I remember seeing it.
The only thing that was funny to me is, like, there was this sense that, like, I didn't enjoy doing the interviews at Q, and, like, I enjoy these ones. It's like, I enjoyed them all. Yeah. I love talking to new people. Like, I find it, like, interesting. But, yeah, I mean, it was like, 5 interviews a day. It was definitely, like, good
super grateful
training. And...
I gotta be honest.
Yeah.
One thing that I wonder about, and especially from your perspective as a Canadian MC, is how do you tell the story of hip-hop without recognizing the fact that it has completely exploded globally and that anywhere you go, people are recasting it in their own image and telling their stories through this form? I don't know how you leave that out, and I don't know how you tell it either, because every country has its own history of hip-hop.
It is actually really fascinating how hip-hop arrives in different places. If we did a Toronto episode, that would be an interesting story to tell. But I can say, as Canadian MC, like, I'm not offended that we're not in it, you know, like, at this point, you know, like, the chronology, you can't move chronologically at a certain point. As you can see with the show, like, once you arrive at 1990-something, hip-hop is everywhere. And it's moving, and you kind of have to make decisions. These guys, I think, make wonderful decisions about, like, how to tell a story about how this music has changed. And I'm not personally offended that we haven't gone to Toronto or, like, to London and the UK. Because, and I'll say this in fairness, I don't think we had a profound effect on the music and culture, like, changing it and shaping it until Drake.
I was going to say, like, I would have loved to have seen Dream Warriors in there.
Yeah.
But I get why they're not in there.
I think Shad pretty much got it in that, again, the prism was always, like, what's happening in the music and culture? How's it changing? And when you look at it like that, it's hard to find examples where the evolution of the music is not driven by Americans.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, so in France, they have their history, but it's influenced by styles from America. In the UK, same thing. where that's not really happening. There's not a real reciprocal relationship there. There's not a lot of American MCs will tell you, oh, I listened to so-and-so from Germany, and that's where I got my style from. So the evolution of the music is mostly being...
It's still the engine, you know? Yeah. It's still like... I don't know, and stuff can happen, but it's really interesting how that still, the center still holds.
Yeah, Drake is really the first international
and you can't
artist
cover...
to change the sound of America.
Yeah, and that actually is a real Canadian contribution, because it's like, I don't know, like the freedom to be emo or the freedom to, you know, to like, a lot of the stuff we're talking about what is the Canadian perspective is like the liberty to be kind of freed from different conceptions of what it is, where you take your inspiration from or what kind of attitude you have to represent.
Yeah, I mean, there is a version, it's funny, there was a version where the whole series ends with Drake. But we decided that we couldn't get that far. We just like, this is too much. We need to end it earlier. But in that version of it, it's the same thing. There's building blocks that lead to Drake. Right?
Yeah.
There's Kanye's 808 and Heartbreaks. There's Kid Cudi.
Wayne.
Right? So they start opening up this lane for Drake to actually exist. You know, so much of music and hip-hop is timing, right? Would Drake doing the exact same thing 10 years earlier would have worked? I don't think so. You needed these sort of primers to get you to the point where the culture is open to, one, different regions contributing, and that took the internet to happen, where sort of those boundaries were broken down. And then the second part of it, where you could have this sound that was more ambient, where you could have consistent mix of like crooning and rapping, which is what Cudi and Kanye bring to it. So there's all these kind of setups, and then you get Drake comes in at the right moment, and it makes sense to the culture, and it can cross over. And then on top of that, he's got an American cosign, which is just that extra push that he needed to build. But once he gets in the culture, he's accepted, and it makes sense at the time, so the sound blows up, right? But it's all built on things that are kind of bubbling
for a while.
So that sounds
like that's a season four thing.
I just gave you an episode, yeah. You know, I was joking yesterday. You know that doc series where the documentarian follows those kids called 7-Up, and every 7 years he checks in with them?
Yeah, sure.
We're doing that for hip-hop. Every 7 years we're going to check in
back,
and make
hip-hop.
We're going to be like 80 years old. It'll be like season 10, you know.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
It's a great show.
For having us.
Thanks, Justin. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
That is your Canada Land for this week. I hope you liked it. If you did, tell a friend, review it. Or if you didn't, you can tell me about it. Or, you know, if you did, you can tell me about it. I'm at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read every email that you send. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com. Go to our website to listen to Oppo. It is interesting to listen to Justin Ling become increasingly angry and even apoplectic as this campaign drags on and the campaigns get stupider and stupider in their messaging. Justin's face just gets more and more virulently purple, and you can actually hear the purple on the show. Oppo's been fantastic. Check it out. Our senior producer is Kasia Mihailovic. This episode is produced by Kevin Sexton and Jordan Cornish. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, if you like our other shows, if our news reports are something that you read and value, all of this work happens because people support us at patreon.com/CanadaLand. Please help us out.
My name is Darby Wheeler, and I am a film and TV director. Directed Hip Hop Evolution, which I believe we're speaking about today.
We have very similar resumes. My name is Rodrigo Bascuden. With Darby, I wrote, produced, and directed some episodes of Hip Hop Evolution.
And my name is Shadrack Kabango. I'm an artist and also the host of Hip Hop Evolution.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
I guess the first thing I would have to recognize is just like the sheer number of people you talk to, Shad. Like, what strikes you first is like you really booked some big stars. Like, it's not just like, you got Snoop and Ice Cube and Ice-T and Sean Combs and LL and Lil' Kim, but there's also like Afrika Bambaataa, Grand Wizard Theodore, Kool Herc, Fab Five Freddy, Roxanne Shanté, like literally the people who invented, some of the people who invented this thing that took over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then Prince Paul is in there, and Primo, and Pete Rock, and like Rod Digga. Whatever happened to Rod Digga? She's in the show. There are over 130 interviews.
Oh, wow.
And you have 4 episodes in your season. So how the hell did you book this show?
At the beginning, first season, it was mostly Darby and I. And we would split it up, sometimes just like based on our sort of psychological profile of what what we thought this person was like. So I got the nerds. Darby got the divas. That was kind of like the division. Uh-huh. Darby would be like, this guy seems like super nerdy. Yeah. He's like, you should talk to him.
But then, 2 hours later, thanks for that.
But we did a lot of the chasing first season. And then second to fourth, we had a dedicated talent producer and then an American producer, talent producer. And then we'd also have local fixers that, you know, were friends or people we found. So it was a real combination of all things. And then also at the same time, we're still doing
it. Yeah, I would say we drove it, though. Yeah, I mean, I used to work on Much Music with George Stromboulopoulos in the hour at CBC. So I know how to chase people pretty good, as Rodrigo does too. Just finding, but with hip hop, it was different. You had to sometimes find like DMC's brother, you know, like, or weird angles to get numbers to old school guys, right?
It's like a game.
So-and-so knows so-and-so. And, you know, hip hop's an industry, but it's also a community. I have to imagine as you get to season three that like word gets around like, well, I mean, it's what we do. We say, well, here are the people who've been on the show so far, and then people can speak of the experience, whether it was a good one or not. So
there's like a domino effect to it, but it is really impressive. Like, I had a call with a guy I know who's like a VP at, was it Universal or Sony in LA? And he's trying to make documentary films about music. He's like, how do you guys get all these people? Because I'm trying to get these people, and they record for us. They're on our label. And I can't get them to sit down for our productions. I'm like, yeah, these guys kind of know how to play this game of like, sometimes it is talking to their brother or the person no one knows who influenced them. Sometimes we'd sit down and have an interview with them, and then we can approach that person we really want to sit down with and say, yeah, we spoke with this person. They're like, oh, you know your stuff then.
We were strategic about it at the beginning, especially. We knew that you could build it bottom up. So you get Kool Herc, and that, you know, that'll make Flash do it, which will make Bam do it. And if you got those three guys, okay, now Melly Mel will do it. Oh, now you got all those guys, so Run DMC will do it. Second, third, and fourth season, it was a little bit different because by that point, the first season it aired, you could say, oh, it's won some awards, you know, it airs on Netflix. All of that helped. It was like a package now.
Part of the pleasure of watching it is there are moments where like, oh, they got this big star, but then just like, oh, like Shad is just walking into somebody's apartment. And on the other side of that door is Grand Wizard Theater. Like I'm just like picturing in my head, like, I guess you just go to the airport and get on a plane and go to New York and get in a cab and then knock on a door. And when that door opens, who's standing there.
Well, the funny thing, and I, from my artist life, I know this too. Like, if I have to sit down for an interview, oftentimes the place I'll suggest is my house. This is easier.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's easier for me. I can just wake up, come downstairs, and we can just, and I'm comfortable. So it kind of works out well because it looks great, but it is also just easier for the artist.
Well, and it's interesting as you get into the history of hip hop, the further you get, the nicer the rooms, you know? Some of the people who are most fundamental to this thing, everybody seems to be doing fine, but like some people are just like, yeah, this is my apartment. And
Kool Herc drove up in a really crappy Honda Civic, like a 1988 Honda Civic, you know, like
in general, the pioneers, like the real pioneers, like the 70s Bronx Harlem guys,
they missed out on the payday.
They didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And even when you move forward, like even through the 80s, like people who are big, like a Rakim or a Kane, like you never really know because the deals were so bad back then.
Yeah.
What they really got. You know, like you have big groups that really never.
I don't think they got any. They tour.
Some of them are still hustling, I guess. Whatever that name can translate into.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard to guess. Like so and so is doing fine, but an equivalent artist who you think would might be okay has nothing, you know?
So it's crazy.
Yeah. You kind of can feel that after a while, like who's doing well, who isn't.
Okay, so Canada Land deals with journalism, and I want to discuss what you did as a work of journalism, and I know you resist the term definitive, but I think it's the most exhaustive.
I would agree with that. Yeah, definitive is tough because there's a lot missing.
How can you? Three seasons so far, four episodes a season. I mean, but this seems like, as an oral history, as an attempt to document it, this seems like the biggest swing at it so far. And it got me thinking about the relationship between hip-hop and journalism writ large, which has been kind of a strained relationship from the start. I think maybe because hip hop itself is a form of journalism, you know, the famous Chuck D quote, this like Black America CNN, and, you know, the emphasis on telling your own story. And I think a real awareness of the power that exists in who gets to tell your story and seizing mm-hmm. that power and saying, well, I'm going to tell my own story. And then when other people come in and tell it, I mean, some of the archival footage you dig up of the early news media reactions to hip hop.
There is mounting concern that the music teenagers are listening to, rap, is getting too explicit.
Susan Pierce is a parent who is not impressed by Two Live Crew.
That's your job as a parent, is to set some standards for your kids.
I think this is nothing but verbal pollutants.
Federal judge in South Florida declared Two Live Crew's album, Nasty As They Wanna Be, obscene by local community standards.
That stuff has not aged well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just the disgust and the demonization.
Two Live Crew is a good example. In season two, there's like a whole news crew of people that's just so great. Yeah,
the moral panic.
Yes.
I mean, and then the Senate committees and Tipper Gore and all that stuff. I remember of just people were terrified. And they were just very dismissive of it as a form.
Yeah, the general sense was it was going to be a trend. Like, it was going to disappear, right? It was a novelty.
Are you all Canadians in this room?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How the hell are you the ones telling the most exhaustive history of hip-hop from the beginning? Like, how is this your work of journalism?
It's funny because, you know, here we are in 2019, and I think there's an understood value of the history of hip-hop now. Yeah. But when this series was first being pitched in 2012, 2013... which is not that long ago, really, it wasn't the same. So when Banger, the production company, was pitching the series, it wasn't like everyone's like, amazing idea. Like, here's your money. Run with it. People were like, not sure if that's going to work. Who cares about this?
They were scared, too.
There was a lot of skepticism about the value of this, of telling this history. So what that did is it presented an opportunity. Because imagine if that's the same conversation that's happening with possibly other production companies or journalists in the United States, and they're getting that same pushback where people are not really interested. So there was an opportunity there for people to come in. And, you know, we just happened to be the ones that got that chance. But I do think there was also an advantage to being Canadian to it. And we heard this from Americans, not just me speculating, in that we're a blank slate. We don't come with any baggage.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a particular bias towards any artists or regions, you know, whereas I think a lot of the more well-known journalists, if they had tried the project, might already be tainted in some way by their history. You know, things that we don't even know about, right? Whatever relationships they had, where they're from, et cetera, et cetera. So being Canadian really kind of like, people saw us without judgment. You know, just like, okay, they're an inoffensive Canadian crew and it's going to be really like nice and innocent, right? Not that there was anything unsavory about it, but they were just open to it. So it helped us from that perspective.
That's one aspect of it. And the other one, I wonder, like, Canadians kind of famously seem to be able to take an overview approach. Like, we just grow up consuming so much American media.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have the same kind of like regional associate. I mean, maybe there is a Toronto to New York kind of thing, that, you know, but there's also just seems to be like, if you're Canadian and into comedy, you become a student of comedy. If you're Canadian and into rock, you become a student of rock.
Right.
Is there like a Poindexter hip hop nerd aspect of this where Canadianness helps you?
I think so too. I mean, it's just like Darby was saying, right? Like, he grew up near Windsor or near Chatham, Windsor area, right? So like certain artists, like let's take, for example, E-40.
The moon is full, look at the dark cloud. Sitting in my scraper watching Oakland going wild, ta-da. I don't bump mainstream, I knock underground. All that other sugar-coated and watered down. I'm from the Bay where we
have... No one in Toronto likes E4, like, to a great extent, right? Like, it's just... But in Detroit, they love E40.
Yeah, and Too Short, I used to buy those records there. So, yeah, I definitely
Houston,
have a
In Houston, they love E40. It's like, I do feel like that's absolutely
a thing. It's a good example, E-40.
E-40 is great. Because if you go to Texas, E-40 is the biggest rapper, like, ever outside of, like, Ghetto Boys.
What about you as an MC from here?
Same thing.
Do you feel like being Canadian frees you from having to kind of be too affiliated with something? Like, you can kind of just love everything with permission to love everything?
I think so. And, like, Drake's kind of a prime example, right? Like, he kind of popped up doing a style that everybody loved in Houston because it kind of touched on what they were doing, and obviously New York, but Fonte from North Carolina is one of his favorite rappers. Like, he is this hybrid of so many styles of rap. He was maybe the first guy to be like, I don't have a cadence. I don't have a style. Like, I love music. I love rap music, and I kind of do it all. So, yeah, I think so for sure.
There's a freedom to that.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. We never really got pushback from people.
I don't think people saw us as outsiders because Rodrigo had ran a hip-hop magazine for a decade, and I worked at, Much, and Shad was already an MC. People were very aware. Like, all the De La Soul guys love Shad. I just remember that, right? Like, so it wasn't that we were outsiders.
That must feel good.
But I definitely, Nelson George, the journalist, he was worked with us on the first season. And me and Rodrigo did some early research sessions with him in Toronto. And that was, he literally, first thing he said was, he goes, "You guys are so lucky to be Canadian. You don't even know." And so we really didn't know, right? But it was that sort of, like you said, like Rodrigo mentioned, no baggage. And I actually think there's, I always said an example to Rodrigo, BBC and English journalism and music journalism did reggae so good. They just covered it. And that sort of was our goal with hip hop, to be, make Canadians be the ones who, like you said, have that lens that could look, and not be so inside, and have things that would curve your perspective in a way.
And then when the door knocks and they open their home to you, and it's you, Shad, they really seem very, very comfortable.
Yeah,
I mean you're a stranger to almost all these people, right?
Yeah, I think the hard thing is getting people to sit down, right? Like the chasing that we were talking about at the beginning. But once they're sitting down, they're talking about hip hop. They love it. Like, I think the best example is probably Lil' Kim. Do you remember that first rhyme you kicked for Biggie?
It was on Fulton Street, right? I was a baby, 16, 17, basically. I'm so embarrassed. But I used to really like Buckshot. I used to rhyme like him. I would listen to Black Moon over and over again. I don't remember it all, but I remember I said something to the sense of, "I'm so hot, I'm hotter than the sun, now where the man or who that to come," or whatever.
You hit him with the Buckshot flow.
Hit him with the Buckshot flow. And he was like, "Wait a minute, what?" Like, that big ass voice coming out of this little ass girl. He was like,
she is in another world now. You can see, like, she's in a sort of a different world. She's still in hip hop, but she's
also. Well, we have to unpack that a bit.
Sure. But yeah.
What's this different world of Lil' Kim's? It's Lil' Kim world.
She's in the world, a world I'm unfamiliar with of, like, dressing up and Instagram and all.
She's like an icon.
She's in a very, very moneyed environment. And I'm like, okay, here's Lil' Kim. And then she's like, she really opens up to you.
A lot of people ask me about that interview in particular because they see the photos and see how much she's changed and they wonder, what's she like anyways? And I was like, honestly, once we started talking about hip hop, she was like maybe the coolest person we talked to.
She
so
is cool.
Cool.
Yeah,
like,
I would agree.
Funny, like street. Yeah. And
still Kim, everybody says that about her. Like, she looks different. Kim. Like, people in her world are like, that's still Kim. Yeah. People always say that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm getting at is like, getting people to sit down for an interview, it's not promoting their project or whatever, is probably the hard part of the game. Once they're sitting down and they're talking about the music they love, the era where all these special things happened in their life, like, they're just happy to do it.
I think that you do connect with them on the level of, like, a mutual love.
Yeah,
and I think
so.
There's something about you, to give you some respect as an interviewer, that again and again rests these very human, unexpected moments out of people who we know as like almost like superheroes or cartoon characters, or like whether they're icons or however you think of them, you don't think of them as just like a person telling a story.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I enjoyed that aspect of it, kind of trying to prepare myself to like receive someone's story, But I do think there's a thing about connecting around music, and it certainly again helped once the first season was out. So like Snoop, for example, saw the first season, loved it. And when he sat down to talk, I think he got what the show is and what we're looking for, right?
Yeah.
So when people had that experience, it was always a lot easier too. Like he's a pro, but he also, because he saw the show, I think he understood.
Yeah,
okay.
He was different though, right? You're right about that. Because I actually I did tell him what we were going to do, and it was about Tupac a lot, right? So he didn't go into Snoop, funny, he had a different vibe about him.
I've never seen him like that in an interview and this moment. And I don't know, like, not everybody listening will know the context of like talking about Biggie versus Tupac like again, like like the subject of like endless dorm room conspiracy theories, Illuminati, there's been documentaries made about this and who assassinated, and then you've just got Snoop like realizing that his own son is the same age as Tupac when Tupac was killed.
I was riding on the freeway and I heard it on the radio station. Like 25, my oldest son is 25 years old. I'm thinking like, damn, that's only how old he was. He did a lot, but he didn't get a chance to do what he needed to do. He had more to do.
And it kind of builds. You've got, you know, Sean Combs just remembering his friend.
I was ready to quit. I wasn't going to put out any more records. Then I was watching TV one day. You know, one of those times of despair that nobody is around. And you're like crying on the floor and the self-pity is at an all-time high. And you're like asking God why. And then I just heard Every Breath You Take by the Police. I just took it as a sign. And sometimes you just need that little bit of light to be able to express yourself. And I thought that the best thing I could do was not give up. I was down and I was out, but I wasn't finished. But all I could do was get up and start to fight. And that's the way, you know, Big would have wanted it.
And you bring him to tears thinking about that. And then the way that oral histories work of like everybody kind of comparing notes. And what you kind of get is a different telling of that, of a story that I thought I'd never want to hear.
Same here.
And the telling is, this was idiotic. This was a tragic series of mistakes and circumstances and accidents that never had to happen. And now there are these two incredibly talented people aren't with us because of it. It's very sad. It was the episode I was least interested in watching and the one that I think I might have learned the most from.
We were definitely concerned about making it because of exactly what you said. You know, it's been covered so much. And we knew, okay, originally we were only going to do one episode about it. And even at points, we're like, should we just run over this whole thing?
Yeah, have them gone.
Give it a quick gloss.
Get out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the prism of the show is what's happening to the music and the culture. That's the guiding principle, which will explain, like, why people aren't there or why people are there. You know, that is our guiding principle. So when we sat back, it was like, we're telling the story of the East and West with respect to how it will ultimately affect the culture, which is what you get at the end of the second episode, which is the emergence of Puff and this jiggy sound of hip hop collectively wanting to breathe a sigh of relief and like look to a brighter sound to forget what they've just been through.
Yeah,
you know?
And the hyper-commercialization that followed and it taking a turn towards party music. Like, you know, that's, you can't skip that chapter.
Exactly. So, but they're connected. They're connected ideas, they're connected moments, that the fact that these tragedies happen and they're sort of this realization of hip hop's collective power and responsibility is a part of the same story as the emergence of the Jiggy era. Mm-hmm. Those are the same thing. They're just, you know, cause and effect in a way. So that was why we ended up telling it the way we did.
Yeah, you're not going to satisfy everybody too. Like you said, there's a million things about Biggie and Tupac's murders, and there's those kind of viewers who are like, why didn't they go tell this part of the story? Yeah. There's a lot of interesting, inside stuff. And
as far as research and writing episodes, that was the one that drove us the most crazy. And editing. Never mind. Yeah, that was the one that drove, because it was just, there's so many pathways you can go down. And you just have to, again, you have to remember what your principles are about. It's like, it's about music and culture, which is why our entry point to that is to explain, this is where hip hop is right now. The West has risen. The East has come back. And now there's sort of this standoff, stalemate. But there's also a history here of kind of like a subliminal animosity that's always existed. So that's why we start there with those stories of like, what was the foundation that could even allow something so silly as a bi-coastal war, which, you know, now sounds just really crazy and ridiculous. Yeah. But at the time, there were like precedents for it. So that's why we go there. So you can understand like how this all unfolds, right? And it was really, that was the guiding principle of that whole episode. How does it happen in hip hop, right? And what is hip hop's story about it?
The guiding principle of the whole thing, I think, is joy. And the way that I think you're able to get the moments you get is through just whatever else is happening. I mean, you're in some strange situations. He's got this dog and like, you know, or you're just in somebody's apartment, like, you know, but whatever happens is like, that's the point that everybody can agree on. And some of those moments, aside from these dramas, like Q-Tip shaking his head thinking about Illmatic and just like,
yeah, yeah.
It's well, a masterpiece. You know,
that was what I was really happy that these guys did in the editing is they made the show entertaining and fun to watch. Because I knew how thoroughly researched it was. But I was like, I hate when music docs, like there's been music docs that I've watched, I'm not going to name them my name, but they're like about a music or era or a group that I love. And I'm like, why am I going to wash the dishes right now? Like, I'm actually bored watching this.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't contain any of the joy that is actually in the music.
In which case, what's the point?
Yeah. Right? So I do, that's probably my favorite thing about Hip Hop Evolution is that it is entertaining. It's fun to watch, just like the music is fun to listen to.
It's beyond that. Like, the look on your face when, like, Supernatural is rhyming and works in Hip Hop Evolution into it.
When it comes to spitting, yo, I'm never disrespected. There is no confusion. Write the Constitution. Sitting here, this is Hip Hop Evolution. Woo! And yo, I'm still here. And that's the way we take it. It's nice. I'ma stop right there because we wrecking it, right?
There's just a sense from you the whole time. It was like, I get to be here.
Absolutely. And I never wanted to hide that. And I wanted to even highlight, like, yo, freestyling is amazing. We don't really do it anymore. Yeah. Like, whatever. Like, it's not exactly part of the culture anymore. But it's amazing. And this is part of why the culture spread. It was because of amazing things like breakdancing and freestyling and, like,
pure skills.
Pure skills and these moments. Like, I do love the Nas section. Because it highlights, yo, when this guy came out, there's a lot of people we talked to, they're like, we were working on albums and we stopped.
Yeah.
Like, really good artists, they're like, we stopped.
Illmatic is right there with What's Going On, Marvin Gaye. Like, it's that good. Like, it really is. It's a masterpiece. And I don't really throw that word around and shit, but it's a masterpiece. Yeah.
Illmatic changed everything. Like, you had to be better, period. And, like, to capture what that means to, like, an entire genre and culture is, like, it should feel exciting. It shouldn't feel anything less than exciting.
And I think it's, like, a history that recognizes it's not just simply, like, the style evolved and this sound came out of this. Like, no, like, individuals, geniuses.
17-year-old, 18-year-old geniuses. Like, how young they were, too, is just, like, amazing. Grandmaster Flash at 13, discovering new ways to use a turntable.
Yeah.
You know, as a junior high kid.
Yeah. Kids.
Yeah. You know, like, revolutionizing music and what that must have felt like when people at a party are hearing a section of a record looped for the first time.
Yeah.
They'd never heard that. They had no imagination for how that could even be possible.
Well, and that's the kind of original joy is taking... Like, it's not supposed to be an instrument. It's something you're just supposed to buy shit with this. You're just a consumer.
And you put it on.
And you turn it into an instrument.
Yes.
And that's a foundational act of joy that everything is built on.
Yeah.
Was there a favorite for you? Was there like an interview that...
I guess I have two categories of favorites. Like, there's some that are my favorite because I really learned something. Like, there was one interview I remember we had with Angie Martinez. And that was just interesting learning about, you know, hip-hop journalism and stuff. But also, there's just a moment in that interview where it clicked for me that, like, oh, hip-hop is New York culture. Because we've been talking about it even here, like, it's an American thing. But it's actually New York culture. I was just talking with her, and she was talking. I was like, she has no other culture but this. Like, this is her life and how she lives and breathes and whatever. So... there are moments like that, interviews that I really like. And then there's just artists that I'm a huge fan of. Like Q-Tip was a big one for all of
Shad
us.
Shad was tripping on when you were Q-Tip. That was the only interview that I noticed that he was a little nervous about. There's two.
Were you nervous?
Yeah.
I didn't even notice that I was nervous. But like I didn't think I would be nervous.
Yeah.
And then just sitting there in front of Q-Tip is like, you just get this like shock of like Q-Tip. Everything my career is because you live.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, he is.
I
don't
know. It's like a weird feeling of like, pretty much most of what I understand of hip hop is like you.
And the people you inspire.
And the people you inspire.
Yeah.
And then, you know, KRS-One would be another highlight of an interview just because.
Yeah, that was a great one.
I always put it this way, like, if you had my job of interviewing all these rappers, but you never heard rap music, you'd interview KRS-One, you'd be like, he's the best rapper.
Right, based on the interview?
Based on the interview.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's so charismatic, it's insane. Today's topic, self-destruction, humiliate the rap audience is bugging. It's one of two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another.
Let's come to the show to unity. We know exactly who we are. This is what it means to be conscious, to be awake, to be aware.
I feel like it needs to be underlined that you are a hell of an interviewer in this.
Oh, thank you.
And you know, we're in the context in Canada land of the Canadian media. How do I get at this? Let me just read you some Globe and Mail headlines about you.
Sure.
Q, why is Shad so bad?
I remember that one. Yeah. That was
rapper broadcaster Shad being replaced as host of CBC's Q. CBC starting with clean slate as Q relaunches under Tom Power. Here's a Globe and Mail headline I can't seem to find. Shad just won a Peabody and an Emmy for his journalism. Why is that not a story?
I don't know. I can't answer that question.
Probably hard for you to have a perspective on it, I'm guessing.
Yeah, no, yeah. I don't know. You know, I don't know. Like, do you think the Canadian media has missed hip-hop evolution? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's been completely ignored.
Hmm.
It's a Netflix show that is being watched. As far as I can tell, Netflix doesn't give you their numbers, right?
So doing really well.
Yeah. It seems like it's doing really well.
Yeah.
Canadians give each other awards for journalism. Like, there are more awards than there are journalists at this point. I don't really give a shit about awards. I want a Peabody. The Peabody is...
Yeah, we're pretty happy about the Peabody.
The Peabody is the broadcaster's Pulitzer. Yeah. That's one of the biggest journalism awards that exists. That's a big deal that you want a Peabody.
We didn't even submit to it. They found us, too, so it's interesting.
Yeah. I think it's weird. I think that... I mean, look, you've been on the show before, and then I've talked about you on the show before, and I thought that you got a raw deal. I think that the way that you were set up, I think that show is a fucking hard show.
100%.
A daily show.
Yes. Yeah.
To put somebody in who hasn't done that kind of work before with the entire eyes of the nation on them following the Gian Gomeshi scandal, that was my feeling when I spoke to you about that. Mm-hmm. It was like, be careful out there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah, I mean, look, I knew that would be... I mean, challenging is an understatement. Like, I knew it would be basically impossible.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I was up for that. And I don't know why, but I've just never cared that much about the opinions of strangers.
You That's enjoyed just, it too, right? I mean, you've told me this.
Yeah, I did. Oh, the job?
Yeah.
I loved it. Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really did.
There is a difference, and maybe it's by virtue of the experience of Q, but I also feel like it's like, I don't know. That's a machinery, and people put you in situations, and you've got to kind of find common ground with people doing theater and people doing this. Like, things, you know, there's no one who's an expert on all of those different things. But the connection you have to this material, I don't know. I just think that because you took so much heat as an interviewer, I feel like as much attention should be paid to the fact that you're very good at it.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
it was
a good training ground. I want to be honest. I was very grateful for Q for Shad because he had this memory thing that was worked more now. Like, you were pretty good memorizing stuff anyways.
Yeah.
But you were on another level. And then also, like, doing voiceovers, he just had a different... I saw it, like, immediately. I was just like, I remember seeing it.
The only thing that was funny to me is, like, there was this sense that, like, I didn't enjoy doing the interviews at Q, and, like, I enjoy these ones. It's like, I enjoyed them all. Yeah. I love talking to new people. Like, I find it, like, interesting. But, yeah, I mean, it was like, 5 interviews a day. It was definitely, like, good
Super grateful.
Training. And...
I gotta be honest.
Yeah.
One thing that I wonder about, and especially from your perspective as a Canadian MC, is how do you tell the story of hip-hop without recognizing the fact that it has completely exploded globally and that anywhere you go, people are recasting it in their own image and telling their stories through this form? I don't know how you leave that out, and I don't know how you tell it either, because every country has its own history of hip-hop.
It is actually really fascinating how hip-hop arrives in different places. If we did a Toronto episode, that would be an interesting story to tell. But I can say, as Canadian MC, like, I'm not offended that we're not in it, you know, like, at this point, you know, like, the chronology, you can't move chronologically at a certain point. As you can see with the show, like, once you arrive at 1990-something, hip-hop is everywhere. And it's moving, and you kind of have to make decisions. These guys, I think, make wonderful decisions about, like, how to tell a story about how this music has changed. And I'm not personally offended that we haven't gone to Toronto or, like, to London in the UK. Because, and I'll say this in fairness, I don't think we had a profound effect on the music and culture, like, changing it and shaping it until Drake.
I was going to say, like, I would have loved to have seen Dream Warriors in there.
Yeah.
But I get why they're not in there.
I think Shad pretty much got it in that, again, the prism was always like, what's happening in the music and culture? How's it changing? And when you look at it like that, it's hard to find examples where the evolution of the music is not driven by Americans.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, so in France, they have their history, but it's influenced by styles from America. And in the UK, same thing, where that's not really happening. There's not a real reciprocal relationship there. There's not a lot of American MCs will tell you, oh, I listened to so-and-so from Germany, and that's where I got my style from. So the evolution of the music is mostly being
It's still the engine, you know? Yeah. It's still like, I don't know, and stuff can happen, but it's really interesting how that's still, the center still holds.
Yeah, Drake is really the first international artist
cover...
to change the sound of America.
Yeah, and that actually is a real Canadian contribution, because it's like, I don't know, like the freedom to be emo or the freedom to be, you know, to like, a lot of the stuff we're talking about what is the Canadian perspective is like the liberty to be kind of freed from different conceptions of what it is, where you take your inspiration from or what kind of attitude you have to represent.
Yeah, I mean, there is a version, it's funny, there was a version where the whole series ends with Drake, but we decided that we couldn't get that far. We just like, this is too much. We need to end it earlier. But in that version of it, it's the same thing. There's building blocks that lead to Drake. Right?
Yeah.
There's Kanye's 808 and Heartbreaks. There's Kid Cudi.
Wayne. Right?
So they start opening up this lane for Drake to actually exist. You know, so much of music and hip-hop is timing, right? Would Drake doing the exact same thing 10 years earlier would have worked? I don't think so. You needed these sort of primers to get you to the point where the culture is open to, one, different regions contributing, and that took the internet to happen, where sort of those boundaries were broken down. And then the second part of it, where you could have this sound that was more ambient, where you could have consistent mix of like crooning and rapping, which is what Cudi and Kanye bring to it. So there's all these kind of setups, and then you get Drake comes in at the right moment, and it makes sense to the culture. And it can cross over. And then on top of that, he's got an American cosign, which is just that extra push that he needed to build. But once he gets in the culture, he's accepted, and it makes sense at the time. So the sound blows up, right? But it's all built on things that are kind of bubbling.
So that
for
sounds
a while.
Like that's a season four thing.
I just gave you an episode, yeah. You know, I was joking yesterday. You know that doc series where the documentarian follows those kids called 7-Up, and every 7 years he checks in with them?
Yeah, sure.
We're doing that for hip-hop. Every 7 years we're going
to
check in
back,
and make
hip-hop.
It. We're going to be like 80 years old. It'll be like season 10, you know.
Congratulations.
Thanks
it's a great show.
For having
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
That is your Canada Land for this week. I hope you liked it. If you did, tell a friend, review it. Or if you didn't, you can tell me about it. Or, you know, if you did, you can tell me about it. I'm at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read every email that you send. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadalandshow.com. Go to our website to listen to Oppo. It is interesting to listen to Justin Ling become increasingly angry and even apoplectic as this campaign drags on and the campaigns get stupider and stupider in their messaging. Justin's face just gets more and more virulently purple, and you can actually hear the purple on the show. Oppo's been fantastic. Check it out. Our senior producer is Kasia Mihailovic. This episode is produced by Kevin Sexton and Jordan Cornish. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like this show, if you like our other shows, if our news reports are something that you read and value, all of this work happens because people support us at patreon.com/CanadaLand. Please help us out.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.